for his patience. It's not because we regard your presentation as any less important, Dr. Horrock. That's Dr. Martinus Horrock, the CSIR Enterprise Creation for Development. And this, of course, is what we call on the kind of agro side, certainly the bio, I think you call it biodiversity. Members, this is really fascinating, and I think when you get through it and hear it, you will agree with me. Short thing they're doing in Switzerland that costs a fortune and the Alps. But own to yourself, Dr. Horrock. And if you just raise your mic to is that about right? And see how it goes.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, for the opportunity to talk to you. Before I start, Chair, I would like to check my time and how much time do you want me to spend on the book?
Well, you know, in the past we have cut people a little short. We have learned from our experience. We've had to now invite special back because they didn't have enough time. So you have sufficient time. Although we would like to do it in the same way you saw us work with Dr. Dupree, and that is, if you've got a halfway point which is suitable for clarification, let us know. So I'm certainly say, you look, you've got a good 25 to 30 minutes. 20 minutes, fine.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Good. I'd like to talk about value addition, obviously, and in particular to South Africa's indigenous knowledge and the way the indigenous knowledge links to a plant biodiversity. Being a scientist, I want to bring a third element into pictures to show how scientific innovation can add value to these two very important South African resources. So by way of background, we'll talk a little bit about what I mean by South Africa's rich indigenous knowledge history, as well as called our plant biodiversity resources. I then want to give you an example of a rural agro-processing enterprise we've created. We've got about 10 such small businesses we're creating in the country at the moment, but I want to give an example of one to illustrate what I'm doing. I want to say that this work is funded by the Department of Science and Technology, Sustainable Livelihoods Unit, and in the end I would make some conclusions. We can talk, maybe take questions at any point in time. So by way of background, as you know, the CSR is a leading technology development institution, but it also contributes to socio-economic development. So one of the two legs of the CSR is also socio-economic development, not just high science. We certainly contribute to national objectives of job creation, including rural development, human capital development, and just meeting basic needs of people like sanitation, water, purification, and so forth. Within the CSR, I'm employed in the enterprise creation for development. What we do, we utilize the science and technology solutions to address poverty and underdevelopment. So this is a very bespoke unit within the CSR, focuses on the less serviced areas of South Africa. In that context, I'm the manager of essential oil and medicinal plants. We source technology not only from the CSR business units, but also from universities, research councils, and any other participant in the national system of innovation. The CSR remains a technology transfer organization. So whatever we do, we aim at transferring technology to create competitive businesses, in my particular case, in rural South Africa. So we currently implementing a portfolio of projects, all aimed at demonstrating the agro-processing business potential that can be harnessed by socio-economically excluded rural communities. People with access to land, irrigation water, but not necessarily the business skills to make a globally competitive business out of South Africa's biodiversity. So why talk so much about South Africa's plant biodiversity? Please note that there's some 34,500 plant species that occur in South Africa. But to put that in context, that's approximately 10% of all plants that occur on planet Earth. Remarkable because South Africa has only about 2% of the land surface area, so we're clearly over-endowed with plant biodiversity. I think it's only Brazil and Indonesia and South Africa seems to have stood in front of the queue when plant biodiversity was leased up. The countries have come forth with really remarkable few species. If you stand at the table now and you look around you, you will see more plant species than occurs in the United Kingdom, for example. There's over 11,700 species that occur only in South Africa, exclusive to this country. The plants occur in highly diverse ecosystems. South Africa has got many, many different species. key climatic conditions on the Kalahari Desert and Makoland, tropical, subtropical, KZN, coastal areas. The significance of this highly diverse climatic conditions is that these plants have evolved over millennia. The African continent is unique so far that compared to USA and the other parts of Europe, we never had glacial ice age. So we didn't have glaciers that set the biodiversity animal kingdom into the sea, which means our plants are extremely old, they're ancient. Therefore, they've evolved all kinds of defense mechanisms to help them survive. And the potential source of biological active metabolites, which of course are important to the pharmaceutical industries, the food industries, the cosmetic industries, agrochemical and related industries occur within these plants. At a genetic level, human diseases, plant diseases have become very similar at the top of the gene tree, which is the reason why some 25% of all known...
Go back to that slide.
Sure.
Now, I see we seem to end at metabolites. The sentence is not completed on our slide.
Yes, I see some PDF of Madam Chair here. But I could not do the playing with that. So
yeah, I'm looking at the committee section here, Mr. Ezer. You'll just need to reprint that page for me. Can you see? Right, thank you. Do go on.
Now let's talk about the indigenous knowledge systems of South Africa. This is a current and active system. It's embodied in the actions of local traditional healer practices. Once you realize that there's a very long history of traditional use of indigenous plants to treat human ailments in South Africa. The remarkable thing is that this is an ongoing science or a culture. Currently, there are more than 200,000 traditional healers active throughout the country. Many years ago, I checked and saw there were some 25,000 general practitioners. I'm not sure of exact figures today in the formal sector. These 200,000 healers treat approximately 70% of South Africans regularly. I've often tried to research what does regularly mean. That means that people visit the traditional healer at least once a year, and they purchase the herbal remedies. Of course, many people many more frequently. Quite profound figures if you think about the population dynamics of South Africa. The knowledge of this potential damage of indigenous plants, however, has never been leveraged for the benefit of sustainable development or systematically investigated to develop new medicines and new drugs. So if you look at South Africa, the question would be, is this an untapped resource that they should be added to? Is this something of real significance? I've already alluded to the fact that a plant biodiversity is certainly unique, and with two other countries, we're certainly on top of the ladder in terms of the biodiversity. But having the plants only for, for tourism and attractive purposes is not good enough. We should try and find a way to leverage value from that. But if you combine this unique plant biodiversity and the unique regional knowledge system particularly to this country, and you add to that the efforts of the national system of innovation, you should be able to come up with value addition. The question is, what has happened in practice? I would say since the Second World War, when scientists became aware that there's pharmaceuticals, new drugs locked up, microorganisms, like cephalosporins, in antibiotics as well as in plants. A lot of research was done also in South Africa. But if you look at South Africa, you would find there is a lot of research findings, a lot of publications, even technology packages and papers coming out of universities. But very, very few new enterprises that cultivate and process indigenous plants, especially those with biologically functional properties like fragrant materials or cosmetic, medicinal and nutritional value. And Honorable Chair, if I refer to rooibos, which I think we should all be proud of, but the issue is we should move beyond rooibos. There's still 24,500 plant species. So, okay, the purpose of this little red arrow is to highlight the fact that there's an innovation chasm. Although there's a lot of scientific output, and there's a lot of activity at universities, they do not get translated into economic activity. They do not need to export products. And that's often referred to as innovation chasm, and that is what I've had the privilege of spending the last decade on trying to demonstrate that it's in fact possible also for rural communities and for small enterprises to cross that innovation chasm. Which led us to the essentials and the medicinal plant, because they are the obvious cases of underinvestment. through the DTI funded fridge studies, it's been proven on a number of occasions that there's a significant international market for essential oils. South Africa is not really a participant in that yet. Look at the global markets. Just the top 30 essential oils have a value of more than 4 billion. Each of those can be cultivated in South Africa. Not really happening at the moment. We do have essential oil industry, but it tends to be byproducts of the eucalyptus, timber industry, or
We don't have the balance of what's on that slide as well on the first one. And I'm wondering if we're not looking, perhaps you aren't looking at right slides. But that one, you've got two lines, lucrative global markets, DTI funded.
Yes.
And I mean, that's important to us. You know, DTI funded fridge study, but we don't have it on what we've distributed.
My point is, Madam Chair, maybe that the document I sent earlier by email was updated, so I think that would be a solution. I don't think fault lies with the coordinator yet. Maybe we have two versions. So my apology for that. Sorry about the confusion. Yes, let me highlight the fact that this venture into trying to add value to essential oil medicinal plants is based on a fundamental understanding of global markets as funded by the DTI fish studies. The one that focuses on aroma chemicals in particular. And then at an updated location. So, given the fact that we have this heritage of indigenous knowledge, we have this history of scientific research, we have all this diverse climatic regions. Look at the product itself, it's a low mass and high value product, ready for export, shelf stable, everything is very attractive. So we also try to understand that if it's an attractive option, can one do on-farm value addition through the processing of the harvesting crops? Because ideally we want the farmer entrepreneur to be an agro-processor with emphasis on the processing, because we generally recognize that the maximum value is added by the processing units, not just by the cultivation. And in that context, we develop a few objectives. We certainly want to identify the suitable essential oil medicinal plant products. There will always be technical production hurdles if a country enters such a new processing area. We need soil solutions to implement that. Create the market niches for the locally produced products. So even though there are well-established global markets for many of the essential oils, if South Africa is not yet known as a producer, we won't be taken seriously. So we decided to focus on demonstration projects to try and achieve that. It is important to develop protocols to assist new entrants into the market. People do have access to land, but the particular way in which you harvest your resources like land and water is rather different for a horticultural crop like essential oil compared to an extensive farming system like maize. We can never forget environmental issues because so much of our country has been degraded because of incorrect farming practices, and we simply do not want to add to that, so environmental issues are very important. There's also acts of government in terms of access to biodiversity, benefits shared with owners of indigenous knowledge that has to be understood. The most important thing is that if we do a project, we must facilitate the participation of developing rural farmers. If there are such wonderful leads and factors coming out of universities, PhD researchers, we should attempt to commercialize any novel, locally invented product, because that creates an ultimate sustainable competitive advantage for the country. Just a quick one on a conceptual framework. Clearly, in the pillars where most of our attention lies, the sector development initiatives, there's absolutely on the right-hand side, you will see beneficiaries, communities, enterprises, and individuals who have needs. They have limited resources and they have particular needs. On the left-hand side of the diagram, you'll see the government departments, the programs, projects and funding. They understand this initiative behind the laws and are funding us. There's also knowledge generations in institutions. People are focusing more and more on the academic activities in solving technical problems and highlight. And also our European Union, particular government agencies, as well as private sector funding. And we are also in close contact with many other NGOs, service providers, people who are stakeholders in this, it's called as emerging change for business activity. Now, but of course, there are many programs, many instruments running at the different levels of government from national right up to local management. We work very closely with all such parties. So just quickly on cyber-start implementer project, we do not have 100% involvement. We immediately involve the local community. So we'll be 98-90% there, but we make sure that we start all projects in conjunction with the local stakeholders. But clearly, we need to continue to increase our mentoring role because the unit has become independent. Once again, this required possibly 5 years that you have seen upon arrow, having started the project, going through the whole natural progression, including mentoring. There's time when we have to exit. That doesn't mean we abandon. There's places like the South African Bureau of Standards, also the CSIR, certain university partners that continue to provide mentoring, but smaller services like chemical analysis or access of materials to the exports and so forth. But not taking away from the fact that it is important that these entrepreneurial businesses must be standalone businesses, not rely on any further government funding. Now, I want to go into a case study with my illustrated, but because I've been rushing through quite a few concepts, Madam Chair, with your permission, if there's any questions at this stage, just a matter of you before I go to the such example.
Thank you very much, Dr. Horrock. Thank you. Members, are there any clarifications at this point before we move on? Rest assured, you will get the updated PowerPoint, which I believe we do have. That'll be there. So you're all on top of the concept. Those of you who were here when we did the Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Act related to indigenous property in particular, there's this linkage there that we need to be aware of, and the different government departments and so on. I just have one point myself on your slide 11. You spoke about conceptual framework for developing the sector, indicating that there was this integrated link of national, provincial, and local policy strategies, programs, and instruments. Were you indicating that this exists, or it is being developed, or it may in fact be amended to accommodate this? Are the essential oils and what would be required captured within the policy, the strategies, and the instruments? Dr. Horrock, thank you.
Thank you for that question. No, it's certainly not a 100% picture. It is ongoing. I think Bomasela Aja is a Department of Agriculture with a very specific mandate. Their mandate they see as excluding new crops, horticultural subjects which have not been proven. They focus on livestock, intensive farming systems. They're waiting for departments such as science and technology to prove that technology can transfer successfully. There is trade and industry which have taken the lead in the market research, but the trade and industry focus a lot around the enterprise creation. We in fact find ourselves in a position where we are already exiting some of these projects, and science and technology is not really mandated to propose the ideal business model. Should it be a Section 21 company, PDY Limited Trust, what should this be? And I think I'm not here to talk behalf of the Department of Science and Technology, but I think they are wrestling with that question. The CSR is, of course, an implementing agent in this regard. So that is just at the statutory business structure level. But towards the end of my presentation, we will revisit this point because you will see that I release some of the major obstacles is the conflicting interests of legislative instruments, unintended consequences of certain rules and regulations, which are in a standalone fashion incredibly important issues like all use licenses and so forth. But I'll just refer to that now, and I'll deal with that in detail towards the end of the presentation. Is that sufficient for your question?
Yes, I mean at the end we will be asking DTI, through Mr. Samanga, just to add to this, because as you say, this is not really your mandate, those aspects. We will get that addition from DTI. But if you would proceed, Dr. Horrock. Julienge?
Yeah, thank you, Sebastian. Maybe also mine will be best responded to by DTI, but let me just hold it now so that we can check. Yeah, the issue of which doctors, do they receive any licenses to operate, or yeah, are they part of the in fact they are part of that indigenous knowledge that they have. So us knowledge in terms of traditional leaders, because the youth medication and the hygiene.
Yes, I just wondered, are we still using the category of witch doctors as a classification or not? Because I thought that this study, I think you should expand upon that, Mr. Samal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm not really competent to comment on whether we should use the word witch doctor. But I thought the word was healer. We will not be involved in the licensing of them, but I think what is important is for us to recognize that they are a very important source of knowledge, as they have been using and prescribing these medicinal plants for years and using these oils for years. So part of the collaboration would actually be to use them as a source, because the medicine is a medicine. If you use it, you've got a headache and the headache goes away. But then the scientists come in to do is to actually identify what are the active ingredients in that particular plant which is responsible for the healing. So they are an important source of knowledge, not just healers, but there are some people who through history have been using several plants either as food, and then you notice that maybe they are healthier than other communities. It's that sort of thing that we need to identify. And then our interest in the detail will be, can that be turned into an industry? I think like what Dr. Orakel has mentioned, that there are some plants which are specific to South Africa. So the idea is, how do we take that? We were talking about plants, the same thing, we were talking about minerals, whatever, that is actually specific to South Africa. How can we turn that into a competitive advantage? How can that be an industry? How can we make tradable goods and services from that particular environment? That would be our main interest.
And also, Mr. Samanga, the other issue is the reference Dr. Horak made to unintended consequences, and, you know, one always gets a certain element of legislation that may not be in alignment and needs to be reviewed. And it would be helpful if DTI could, working with other departments, identify the legislation that is, you know, has the unintended consequences and remove the conflict and ensure that they are in alignment with each other, because we wouldn't want the sort of commercialization later being impeded in any way. Thank you very much. Over to yourself, Dr. Horak.
Thank you, Madam Jane, and thank you to the honourable members for those questions. I will elaborate that by way of example, but let me briefly, by way of introduction, say that the rights of Indigenous knowledge holders are protected through the Biodiversity Act, and a custodian of that is the Department of Environmental Affairs. I will then continue to talk about the fact that a consortium of traditional healers approached CSR during the early 1990s, I think about 1993, to establish collaboration. They became aware of our work in this field, and they thought they would want to have at least some of their medicinal plants scientifically validated, but that will also empower them in their discussions with the Department of Health, which is at the stage of struggling to understand what is the formal role of a traditional healer in South Africa, even at 200,000 practitioners, which is about tenfold more than the Western style trained medical doctors. The aim clearly from CSR side, and that is why they pushed us, was to scientifically validate the knowledge of the healers on the beneficial uses of the various plant species. So what resulted from that? The result was invention of a novel shape of talent program by the CSR. Subsequent to that, quite a few others, but that was the first example. The way it worked, and I'll possibly tell you in another manner, like a storytelling mode, we were approached by these healers that noticed that in the Kruger National Park people use products that we call tamar from beetle seed and rub it on the arms to keep mosquitoes away. They have a little way. They take a shrub, indigenous shrub called the Iranica. And remarkably, this is not known widely. It's held by a very small group of people with underlayers of traditional healers. And they take the shrub and they pick up a branch and rub it against their arms and they hang it in their dwelling for the evening. Now, PA gives off an aromatic chemical that is repels mosquitoes very efficiently. It took us a few months to investigate this scientifically, and we were surprised to the efficacy of this essential oil. We could identify an essential oil from this indigenous plant. And this study is in the Medical Research Council in Durban, as well as the African Bureau of Standards. It was found that this is vastly superior to citronella, which is a quite well-known product, and it is sufficient as diethyl toluamide, which is an active ingredient sourced from a petrochemical industry as a byproduct, kind of a shell process, which is certainly a way of repelling a mosquito, but it's not an entirely safe manner. There are some individuals which are affected by diethyl toluamide. So this looks like a good example for further research. So right at the beginning, we had like a relationship with traditional healers, and we were awaiting some government regulation that will guide the CSR in terms of benefit sharing. Because clearly people approach us, if a normal company, a private company will approach the CSR, will enter into a benefit sharing agreement through some contractual obligation. So we eventually, in 1998, entered into a benefit sharing agreement with this consortium of healers with our royalties on sales on pay, which their rights to us. That preceded for some 5 years, 2003, Biodiversity Act. That's 2003 Act. I think that was still signed by President Mbeki at the time. That protects the rights of traditional healers. So in a way, this pilot project demonstrated to government that it is a priority to actually hasten the legislative process in the area. Okay, so we then started with three community-based essential oil animal processing farms. They're all currently in production to produce insect repellent oil. We licensed a local engineer to manufacture and distribute the final in product format, basically a tin with a label, and it goes through another regulatory process managed by the Department of Agriculture, which controls the utilization of pest agents and mosquito repellents. And this invention certainly provided us with an opportunity to demonstrate the value of beneficiation of local natural resources used traditionally. And this is a key thing. I want to take you back to those three bubbles I showed. You combine scientific innovation with a plant biodiversity linked to indigenous use. So this is a plant growing. I said it's a shrub. It is not an uncommon shrub, but it's a very specific chemotype, but briefly a chemotype. It's a genetic version of a plant which has a particular property. So sometimes plants look alike, but their chemical substances are quite different, which explains why certain fruit are sour and some others are sweet, and so forth. This is in Giyani in Limpopo, a 30-hectare site. It was the first time this indigenous crop was cultivated. And this is harvested automatically here. Then in the background you see a factory building. In such a factory building you would get a distillation factory. It was the Alfred, the molded man that's managing the distillation factory. How it works, to extract the active ingredient from a plant, you need to pass steam through it, dry steam, and the steam strips the essential oil out of the leaves of the plant. The essential oil is then mixed with the steam, but when the steam condenses, the oil flows on top of the water, the condensed water, and that essential oil is harvested, it's formulated with wax, and that's put inside a tin, and that tin then you burn like a normal candle, you get the aroma coming off it. That's exactly what happens if you would rub this shrub against your arms. And you can see here this formation of the candles, so the ingots are molded for the candles. And that is what the candles look like. You can find them in more than 200 stores in South Africa today. And they take the market by storm. We now have an invitation to distribute this in the USA. That will require significant further investment because we do not have sufficient supplies. I don't think we have sufficient supplies to feed the South African market. Thank you, that's an opportunity. I would just want to emphasize that we're not just focusing on one project and one medicinal farm and one essential oil crop in one province. We have a viewpoint of addressing the whole country. You'll see we pay attention to the coastal regions, to the Arab northwestern part of South Africa, the three state areas. Places around Lesotho are like alpine region of South Africa where it's literally cold. You want to grow, for example, the Pia Valica there. So we have different plant species we do. This is in Kala, which is a community close to the Harib River. This is in Namibia. They grow rose geranium. Rose geranium, of course, is a hybrid of two South National George area, done by French, remarkably not grown in South Africa, although it's actually the derivative of South African plants. We now, not prior to the CSR's involvement, we realized that when the French left South Africa after they established the wine industry, they wanted to find a South African hybrid. But as I said, close geographically to the climatic zone of South Africa. So they went to Reunion. That was a province of France, which is the closest to South Africa. So Reunion became world famous because this is a substitute for rose oil, which is used in very, very expensive perfumes. And eventually, with all the Francophile countries in South Africa, you will see an African continent. Wherever the French are colony, people will be growing rose geranium. And Egypt today is a major producer. But one of the missions of the CSR was to try and rectify the situation. So today, we, from zero, we're now producing 1 or 2% of the 600 ton market of the essential oil, a global market. On the right hand side of this picture is a typical essential oil preservation factory. This one is in the rural Pelican community. This one is from Panagusha, close to Port Elizabeth. That's the rural area. That is also the rose geranium. Of course, as I said, the CSR provides certain feedback in terms of chemical analysis. On the right hand side, you see Kumani Sun River, managing the electric oil station. The Kumani Sun River is an extremely arid desert area, so we need to monitor very closely what's going on there. And below in Victoria, 1,000 kilometers away, is a communication system that allows us to advise them daily. I mentioned colder parts of the country. Vicksburg is a cold area, but it turns out to have a climate very similar to Bulgaria. Now, why Bulgaria? Because Bulgaria is known to be a world-class producer of Rosa de Messina oil, which is ultimate high-value essential oils. No expensive perfume can be manufactured without Rosa de Messina. So South African perfumers import about 105,000 rand per kilogram, and that's just a little bit more than 1 liter they import as well. And yet we found, based on our studies, that the species is suitable for growing cold climates like Pittsburgh. So we set about and we started the first 5 hectare site, and it was a resounding success. So from a horticultural point of view, we could find we could do the importation of the genetic material, we could propagate it, and we're in the process of setting up a hydrogenation process based on recycled engine oil as a fuel source. That's better than using diesel or paraffin. But we also have a region in mind. We also have a similar project in Uganda. We were invited by the Ugandan Industrial Research Institute to transfer the knowledge gained in South Africa to help them also to develop their sector. The idea is to collect countries who benefit from our experience while we also develop a good relationship and learning from them. So we're now in a phase 3 pilot operation currently in Uganda. They were trained in South Africa, Ugandan scientists, and we take regular visits. There's some pictures of what is happening in the country at the moment. Let's talk a bit about the requirements, because the people often ask us, but can we participate? So what is the requirement? This is not a cottage industry. This is not something you do in your backyard. You must average 30 hectares. So 30 hectares is not a big farm for a commercial farmer to plant maize. But it's quite a big farm if you plant a horticultural subject like the essential oil. So you must have at least 30 acres of arable land with access to irrigation, water. You need to have three-phase Eskom power, which is not available everywhere in South Africa. Job creation, roughly 2 hectares can be covered by each worker. So you need about 15 workers whenever you have a 30-hectare site. You absolutely have to have the distillation factory on the farm. The reason for that is there's only 0.1% of the biomass that you produce represented by the oil. So you cannot transport 1,000 kilograms trucks all over the country to a central processing facility and handle 1 kilogram of oil. So you have to construct a factory on the farm, hence 38 acres, to make sure you can actually repay your capital costs. But on the well-managed farm, the financial returns from the sale of oil is sufficient to cover the cost of the area of the provision, the cultivation, and the profit. However, it does require a significant commitment from workers and management. This is not a highly mechanized industry, which on the one hand is positive because it creates more jobs, but it requires very careful management. Now, I'm going to end my discussion now by talking about other requirements for establishing an essential oil production site. This is now more to do with the regulation. This addresses an issue which I feel strongly about, namely that there are some unintended consequences when the different government departments become the custodians of different regulations. have your national legislative framework, but initially there is a province somewhere that has the issue of permit, and people don't always understand the big picture. Let's talk about NEMA. It's amended in 2008, of course, the Department of Environment. Within there, there's a lot of actions on the national, the biodiversity act is a very important one. The key one of the biodiversity act states that you have no rights, no person has got a right to commercially exploit value addition products from any piece of biodiversity, whether it's a living organism from an animal kingdom or a plant kingdom or microorganism, if you do not protect the rights of the owners of the original knowledge. And that is where the traditional leaders come into play. And that's why CSIR has a benefit sharing agreement with traditional healers for that seed to repair product. And we've now already made a third tranche of payment of them. They actually earn 6% of the sales of the end product. The end product being the highest value product. So there's 6% of the turnover created through that project. So there's a financial return. But more importantly, we also validate their knowledge. I think it empowers people, rectifies some thinking that people are really just looking at bush medicine. It proves that there is economic value in what they're getting to some knowledge. So you have to apply for integrated export and bioprocessing permit to make sure that no one exports a valuable Lithium Ionica plant. Very important, very good. You have to have a material transfer benefit sharing agreement. It worked well for the one of the CSIR became involved, but it becomes a hurdle for a rural community that wants to enter this area. Because legally they're not allowed to cultivate the indigenous species without going through everything you see there in a third bullet. And let me assure you, this is complex. This is complex for the CSIR to do an integrated export, bioprocessing permit, a material transfer agreement, and a benefit sharing agreement. And we've got a legal office of 4 or 5 attorneys and assistants for this. So you've really got to spend a lot of energy doing this. We're helping entrepreneurs at the moment, and I'm really surprised again how complex it is. Just to find out who is really the owner. Is this a chief of a rural village? Is it a wild family? If you talk about a material transfer agreement, what quantity is it? You don't want to hear it. No legal requirements. I don't think that was the original intention. It was the intention was possibly to prevent a private company from a northern hemisphere country which is highly developed, zooming into South Africa, collecting some seeds, flying out and planting it in our country and ignoring us. That would be very, very wrong. But I think that thinking must be adjusted to the fact that there are also South African entrepreneurs. And while you have to have a tough system if you prevent a USA-based pharmaceutical company coming in, it really becomes unpractical for a traditional community to also go through exactly the same process. Air Quality Act, really, we creating steam. That is the right thing to do. Fortunately, the borders are designed, they always cost air quality, but that's important. The Waste Act, there's actually no waste in the sensor industry, because you make compost with your sterilized feed that comes out of the border. But you have to go through the process. If another thing, a rural farm will have to accommodate. Before you plow any piece of land to these National Heritage Resources Act, you certainly do not want to disturb ground which maybe hundreds of years ago would be in a traditional graveyard. That is important, but it's an expensive consultant. It will possibly charge you R100,000 before you will repair. You completed the study and this is conform to the national. That type of financial resources is just not available to a rural community that wants to make use of an additional piece of land under their ownership. The National Water Act is extremely important. If only the Department of Water Affairs will have a more streamlined process to allocate such water use licenses. You basically have to say what the purpose is of using the water. Do you have a product with commercial potentials? In this case, it's of course so. And how much water you would use. And then they would then start creating issues. I think there's too much emphasis on the usage of a huge mine somewhere, which wants a water use license for 2 trillion liters per day or something, to whatever they do with platinum. But that same water use license is also applicable to a community farm that uses 3,000 liters per day. And I think this is another example of unintended consequences. We cannot fault the officials within the departments to be very careful before issues these licenses. But certainly these people are not going to create havoc with because water resources and they have a 50-acre site. The Conservation of Agricultural Resources Act, the CARA, is very important. That prevents farmers from plowing downhill fields and cause soil erosion and so forth. I have no fault with that. And I think that is well managed by the Department of Agriculture. The OSHA is of course very important, occupational health and safety. We are proponents of that because people to work in a very safe environment. So, by way of conclusion, I'll end by saying agro-processing with high value chains for all some additional plant aggregation is a viable opportunity. That's what the CSR have found through some 27 projects that currently we're eating off the last 10 of them. It is a viable opportunity. It is linked to the market value, the intrinsic market value, which was proven not by the DST or CSR, but by the DJ studies. And we've also proven that by moving some 5 million rand worth of all just for test marketing in the last few years. All producers could be very size. It's not a cottage industry, you qualify to 50 hectares at least. Technology transfer process, the market access models are proven, that's the easy part. The wealth creation leads to job creation. The emphasis is not to create as many jobs as you can, but to create wealth through the enterprise. That company then, whatever format that will be, will then have funds to create jobs for people. But it's also a bug. The big bug is that the business models for the enterprises and communal land is not yet proven. Possibly because CSR implementation project was focusing on technology transfer and was funded by the Department of Science and Technology. It basically comes from a poverty there in funds of years ago. And I think maybe it's also, I've heard the Director General of DST mention that this is really not their mandate, this is really ETI mandate. The management of the working capital, issues such as cash flow management and ongoing maintenance remains a challenge. Being a technology transfer organization, CSR always will have start to a project, but also an end of a project. We're a project-based organization, so we clearly cannot remain involved for a long time. There seems to be a vacuum. At this age, we're about to exit 3 or 4 projects, and it's not very clear to me whether the Department of Science and Technology understands what has to do with the government-funded assets. Was it a installation factory is worth 1.5 million rand, a tractor is worth 300,000 rand. Those assets should not be naturally transferred to the community. The question remains to what legal entity, say a company, and there's some confusion there. I'm personally convinced that business partners may be required. It's a very long reach for a rural community to suddenly move into a processing enterprise that trade globally where it follows. And unfortunately, it is my opinion that legislative framework actually is stifling the growth of the sector. It's just very difficult for new entrants into the market. Formal farmers can, commercial farmers can deal with this, but I think it's just too much of a hurdle for rural farmers. And with that, Madam Chair, I thank you for the attention of the honourable members, and that's all.
Thank you very much, Dr. Horrock. And I was fortunate, I had heard this before, but I really appreciated getting the input again. And you emphasized the fact that, you know, CSIR, through science and technology, will be exiting the sort of thing, particularly when it comes to the business and commercialization side of it, and it will then move on to the ETI. Is that correct? You know?
That is my understanding, but that's to be verified with the Department of Science and Technology.
And I just want to ask Mr. Samanga if he wants to add anything before I go across the members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what you're actually talking about memorizes what I mentioned before, that our job is to then realize it, we are a trade from wherever in the world we have. And in this case, the case has been made that there is actually a trade. There is, we can generate a trade, which can even go a long way in dealing with issues of rural poverty and rural development.
But I think what's important is page slide 25, that indicates the legislative challenges that going this route we would be facing, in which you referred to, Dr. Horrock, is the legislative framework stifling growth and the need to take that into account. And I think that also applies then to ETI itself and to the portfolio committee. If we are going to promote the value addition in this area, then it is going to require a review of some of the challenging aspects of the, or some of the impediments that the existing legislation would pose, and perhaps with unintended consequences, as you quite rightly say. Now, members, it's owed to ourselves briefly then. Are there any comments or questions on the presentation? Thank you, Honourable MacPherson.
Thanks, Chair. You know, this sort of presentation really excites me because I think, you know, we talk about unemployment specifically in rural areas. You know, these are the sorts of projects that can really assist in creating community-based employment. And I think that your conclusion, which I'm a strong advocate of, that wealth creation leads to job creation, I think that this is one of those sort of projects that really locks into that ideal. And I've got a very simple question for you, sir, in that what are the inhibitors from actually seeing, you know, something like this really being an important priority or seeing sort of a rollout under agro-processing through DTI? You could sort of put your thumb on one thing that's really sort of, you know, holding this sort of thing up. What would that be? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Lee Yang.
And Sebastian, let me also appreciate this presentation. It's really important to assist our communities to develop themselves where they are by utilizing their indigenous knowledge. My question is with regard to such innovations and indigenous knowledge by our own people. Shoring animals. Can we also license such knowledge as it applies to human beings? Because there is a lot of people who are curing certain diseases, a lot of diseases in animals, but they do that for nothing, of which I believe they can actually establish community cooperatives to assist in that regard, more especially that there is not much veterinary doctors. They are needed most, but with the help of this kind of knowledge, it can actually respond to that need.
Thank you, Dr. Yenge. Is that all from members? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the first question, what are the inhibitors to rolling out on a large scale? I will be the last person to indicate we should go back to what marketing boards, remember? The base board, all those marketing boards we had. But of course, South Africa is entering a vast $4 billion US dollar market, global market. We are not yet known, so I think it will be important if we roll out on a large scale, we have a central marketing effort to not just like every Tom, Dick and Harry run across to France and Europe and try and sell a few liters of oil, but to have a brand South Africa to say these are scientifically validated, high quality, good manufacturing practice, good farming practice produced products, which will be consistently good quality and good price. And then introduce South Africa. We've achieved that with the rose geranium, but that's only 1 of 20 of the oil. So I think the systematic, large-scale approach will have to have a coordinated marketing effort. This happens, of course, with many ETI industrial shows, realize that. But also, there are many commercial farmers in South Africa. They tend to run mass enterprises. Many of them operate at the level of a managing director more than a farmer. They fly from farm to farm. I think we should not focus our efforts involved in such farmers. We should see this as rural enterprise creation projects. And then as a platform, and there are such platforms under the Department of Trade and Industry, there is, and I see that there is a COB, but they are a limited group of people with very limited resources. And I think a lot more needs to be done. There has to be a rethink. And I also believe that we must not make a mistake by being too over-enthusiastic to involve rural communities and bring a lot of pressure on them. Because in some cases, I have been communicated to me that we must not overemphasize the empowerment model, because people do not have time simply, the facilities to send emails to ST Law in New York, but what is the status of the last two tons of oil? They would rather have business around that. So I think it's a migration path towards that enterprise model. We need to have business partners to a more active informal sector to help the rural farmers, and then have an upscale strategy. reports, I think there's a sufficient work done by the CSR to understand what thematic regions are required for which types of essential oils. So I hope that's done justice to that question, honourable member. But the most biggest inhibitor is that there should be a cohesive and a strategic marketing strategy to prevent people. If you would, for example, create a fund and 100 people would access that fund, it could be low finance and all run overseas with 10, 20 kilos of oil, that will just balance South Africa. That's not the way to do it. I can refer to how the tea tree essential oil was commercialized through Australia. It was four young entrepreneurs that received government support. And today, tea tree is well known. Before it started, it was an unknown product. No one knew what tea tree is. And that was a systematic, cohesive approach. Today, tea tree is all over the world, so I think we should do something at that cohesive level. But not forgetting the ultimate aim is to create jobs in deep rural areas, not to leave us people out of the fold. And the second question, yes, on the veterinary products, I refer to honourable member to work done in Office of Poor. I believe that work is part of the University of Victoria, and the retired expert there is a certain Professor Kulis Yeloff, and he's now being replaced by other people. They have also systematically harnessed the indigenous knowledge on the use of plant remedies as veterinary products. And I think they've got patents, and how far they are with the commercialization of that, I'm not sure. But I am, in fact, maybe for the benefit of the members, I'm retiring from the CSR within a week or two at the end of October, and I have been approached by such units to assist them also with the commercialization. So clearly there is a need for academic staff to learn and understand how to progress such discoveries they've made. But I think that is quite systematic. Unfortunately, it's the only unit in the country. So, but then also it is a world-renowned science against the program. But should the honourable member want to be in contact with them, you can just contact the University of Victoria and also put branch of veterinary plant medicine faculty.
Thank you very much, Dr. Warwick, and thank you for your time here. Yes, it was a very different sort of presentation and gives us better insight into what we can add value, but also the challenges sometimes with not ensuring all the legislation is aligned. So we will look at that again and take that forward. Mr. Simon.
Thank you, Chair. I think something that just comes up from the presentation of from Ms. Larson, and that's the issue of skills and developing people. He's saying he's living in a few, I don't know if this, he's saying he's living in the CSR at the end of the month. I don't know if this committee has got the powers to cancel that resignation or something. But I think at the end of this, it's a question of how do we harness, just as much as we want to harness the natural endowment, how do we harness the skills? How do we make sure that even in retirement, people who are active continue to be active? How are skills passed on from one generation to the next generation? And in Africa, this is something that we've always been doing. Skills were passed on from mother to child and father to child, but then in a formalized way, like we have, he goes away and the whole skill goes away, or whatever he has been doing as a child goes away. So I think that's part of in consolidating the reports right across all products that we've been dealing with. I think the issue of transferring knowledge is important.
I do, and thank you for highlighting that point. Certainly, Dr. Horrock, you know, you may, I take it, you are taking, is it you on retirement? Is that the idea? Very young pension, as it were. So, clearly, you know, we, CSIR, I'm sure we'll know where you are, but for us to access that, and it would also be pertinent for us to note in our report that when we do know these critical skills are leading us, we need to assess what has been transferred already within the institution. And is it possible for that to continue to be the case perhaps at an academic institution? Although I do know CSIR is somewhere in between an academic institution and a commercial institution, and has been very valuable. But we do hope that you will retain your relationship with CSIR. That would be my hope, because this is a very important area. It is a new area that we are beginning to explore. It was seen very effectively in areas where it's very difficult to create jobs, formal employment. And here's one way we are doing it. So thank you very much for your time here. And please ensure that I do have your contact details before you leave.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members of the, and thank you very much, Mr. Sanga. Thank you so much. The issue on the minutes, and just to go back to the 12th, the spelling has been cleaned up here. To go through that again, that was the only error there, and that was already adopted, proposed and adopted. Am I correct? The 12th, yes. The 16th, we hit a glitch there under resolution on page 3, not knowing when these were arrived, so as we pass these, we'll note later that when it was done. And we have somebody now to propose the adoption of the 16th of September. Thank you, Honourable Luyenge. And we have somebody to second it. Thank you, Honourable Kornhoff. And now I can indicate to you that the responses were received on the 23rd of September. And if you look at that, that was within the 10 days, and they were distributed on the 25th to members. And that would have been at the training session. But we also start off with an hour for us of committeelessness. That's the 12th, that is the 16th, and then we have the, should have been the 19th here. Has also been corrected, the spelling of your name, Honourable Luyenge. So page 1, the 19th, that was the only challenge we had there, and page 2. Can we have those? Someone's proposed adoption of those minutes. That was the heat. Honourable Luyenge, you can't do those. You had an apology unless it's incorrect. The yeah, let's just see under your name. Is that the one that is not corrected? You see, it should be under present. Okay, it was corrected. You must have corrected one copy. Right, so that has been corrected. Thank you, Honourable Yenge. You're proposing that seconded by? Thank you, Honourable McPherson. We also have the 25th. Which was a training day, but we always start off with some committee business. And this is a very big amount, and I'm just deciding that we'll have to take that through tomorrow because it's far too, or Friday, for us to simply wade through. So it will be distributed today or tomorrow to you. That's Thursday the 25th. Thank you very much for your attendance here today. And the meeting is adjourned until Wednesday. I want to refresh your memory. You were emailed and received a hard copy of the BRRR. That gave you the opportunity before the weekend and today, yesterday, to look at it politically, so you could prepare.